Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimpera, host of the Public Policy Channel, and today Gene Slater joins us to talk about his new book, Free to Discriminate: How the Nation's Realtors Created Housing Segregation and the Conservative Vision of American Freedom, from Heyday Books. So, Gene, if you would, start us off by telling us a bit about yourself and your background and what it is that brought you to this book, please.
Sure. Thank you. So my background for the last 45 years has been working in financing affordable housing, where we've been one of the leading advisors on affordable housing around the country to state and local agencies, from helping create home improvement programs back in the 1970s in Pittsburgh that fixed up 18,000 of the 72,000 single family homes, to public housing revitalization, to mixed income housing in the suburbs, to home ownership programs around the country. So that's sort of my background. And part of what got, there are two things really that got me interested in what became the story of this book, and really it's the story of my own learning, is how little people who've worked in affordable housing know about the history of housing segregation, that we sort of operate in a world in which, you know, we deal with zoning and we deal with planning and we deal with housing issues and sort of all the consequences that have happened to the country from having segregated neighborhoods, disinvestment here and exclusion there. So that's part of it. The other, though, was a question that I asked. It was actually in a human rights seminar at Stanford, which was, how did it happen that conservatives on almost all civil rights issues argue that extending civil rights, you know, limits American freedom? Where did that idea come from? And it turned out that it came, in fact, from America's realtors back in the 1960s, who used freedom to try and defend residential segregation in the battle for fair housing. So it's sort of the relationship between these two things, between the history of how did we wind up with, in some ways, these two defining features of modern America, which is having segregated neighborhoods that have sort of driven the design of all our metropolitan areas and where people live and who their neighbors are, and a conservative vision of freedom that's helped drive the country to the right for the last 50 years, that these two defining features of modern America, sort of our political divides and our racial divides, were in fact both created out of the effort to segregate neighborhoods in this country.
Excellent. So that feels like a perfect setup for us to maybe start by digging into a little bit of this history. So you begin the historical narrative looking at the activism of real estate interests initially in California in the Progressive Era. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that story, and then perhaps why it is that you think it still matters and why we should care about it?
Yeah, I think, let me do it in the context of segregation for a minute. Perfect. I think it's important to realize this sort of a myth that, and it's a myth the realtors promoted, that America, that cities have always been segregated. The segregation is normal and natural and historical. But in fact, if you go back to the beginning of the 1900s, throughout the country, cities weren't segregated. Neighborhoods were racially mixed in many areas. People lived in areas that they could afford. Often there are minorities who lived in poor areas, but those were scattered and spread out and mixed racially in cities across the country in 1904. A Los Angeles real estate broker took pride in how, as he said, Negroes of this city have proudly refused to segregate themselves and live in many of the better areas. And this was true not only in Los Angeles, but in cities around the country. So it took some, but by 1917, in the same city, an African-American woman said, "We've been surrounded by invisible walls that have encircled us, and that whites have prevented us from going beyond." So what happened in those years was the creation of segregation as a whole racial system that then spread out and operated within every city in the country. And it was the product of the organized real estate industry. And so it took something. It wasn't simple. Segregation didn't arise as a result of racism. Yes, racism obviously drove this. But there had been racism was certainly strong in 1900 as it was in 1920 or 1950 or, you know, during the Battle of Fair Housing in the 1960s. It took something else. It took an organized real estate industry. And that industry and how that became organized is really the story in some ways of the application of the progressive movement to real estate in this country. That at the beginning of the 1900s, local real estate boards started forming, originally as a way to control fraud in real estate, to distinguish themselves. A real estate agent was generally known as a shyster. And there were stories endlessly of fraud and abuse and so forth. And so a small group of the most established brokers in each city put together real estate boards that would say, we are the people you can trust. We created a multiple listing service that became effectively a monopoly that allowed them to control 80% of home sales. They got licensing through state governments originally in California. So they really came to control the real estate industry. And it was only because they controlled it as all white real estate boards who focused on limiting who could join them. Because their view was, in order to really control the industry, in order to have an influence, in order to dominate home sales, they needed to control who their membership was. So they had secret membership committees that blackballed applicants, limiting them precisely to people who they socially wanted to be associated with and felt they could trust. That excluded all minorities. So it was that organizational framework that was necessary for segregation to happen. It couldn't happen with just everybody competing willy-nilly to just find the best real estate deal for a buyer or seller. It took an organization that was trying to limit how homes were sold.
So, and you describe these organizations as basically private clubs, right, in the way in which they functioned. So can you talk a little bit about sort of what were the policy innovations, right? So this is the root of sort of the modern version of zoning laws, for example, yes. Right? What are the kinds of things that they were agitating for as a matter of public policy beyond just mere practice of agents?
Okay. So in the same way, so these were real estate boards were, as progressives, were strong advocates of regulation. Regulation was necessary for American progress and stability. And they viewed stability in real estate, sort of their key goal, as a function of what they called the law of conformity, which meant like things with like. And part of this, so the Los Angeles Real Estate Board pushed for what became the first zoning in the United States in 1905 that limited all industrial uses, excluding from all residential areas in the city. They then pushed eventually for more detailed zoning, including the first single-family zoning in Berkeley in 1916, which was a way of limiting and saying that the real value of real estate consists of not what happens on this individual parcel, but what happens to those around it. And it was this idea of conformity that led to zoning and led to city planning and realtors, that was the trademark of the members of local real estate boards. Realtors then were the leading advocates, and they saw the creation of zoning as sort of one of their great accomplishments in their industry, along with rooting out fraud in real estate. They saw this effort. This effort then got applied to race. And how it got applied to race is an interesting story in itself, which was that, as I said, segregation didn't exist at the time. And a couple of pioneering realtors, members of local real estate boards, one in California in Berkeley, Duncan McDuffie, another in Kansas City, J.C. Nichols, both in 1905 separately, came up with the same approach. They decided what they were going to do was sell high-end subdivisions, create high-end subdivisions that would in some ways be the classiest in the country, with curving streets and trees, so forth, developing a whole large area, using the kinds of landscape designs the Olmsted brothers, who had designed Central Park and later, that they were using. But to build these high-end developments, you would build them out over many years with a lot of infrastructure costs. They were concerned about their profit. Their income really came from the last units that they would sell, the last lots that they would sell. So they decided in a world without zoning that the way to control what would happen on these later lots was to put in covenants, deed restrictions that limited what each neighbor could do on the property around you. Many of these were you had to keep the street trees or the trees, you had to build a house of a certain size or of a certain cost, things to maintain the neighborhood. To these list of covenants that had been used originally in a subdivision Roland Park in Baltimore in the 1890s, they added one more. It was one that cost them nothing. And this was a covenant that said each person who signed it, each owner, had to say that for the next 30 years, no one other than a servant could be non-Caucasian, could live in the house on this property. These deed restrictions, racial covenants, they instituted, and this became so popular. It started being adopted not only by these high-end developers, but very quickly by developers of middle-class homes, middle-class subdivisions, and then working-class subdivisions. And by the 19-teens, realtors in existing neighborhoods started circulating petitions that everybody would sign. And once three-quarters of them signed it, then anybody, if one of them or the person they sold the house to ever sold to a minority, then the neighbors could sue to evict that person and who would lose the house, which had an enormous chilling effect. And by the 1920s, these kinds of covenants were on, you know, half the homes in America and most of the new homes. So this is sort of how segregation began, originally as a way to solve a land development problem, a control problem, but it fit this idea of the law of conformity. Why was it originally created when Duncan McDuffie was doing these in Berkeley in 1905? It wasn't likely that the relatively few Japanese Americans or African Americans in the Bay Area at the time were going to afford the most expensive house lots, you know, in the entire Bay Area. It was a form of social cachet. It was a way of saying your children will always play with neighbors' children like them. So that was really how segregation began.
So looking at the end of this period of expansion as these practices find their way throughout large swaths of the rest of the country, it also becomes something of an axiom that people of color will drive down property values. And this, of course, winds up being folded into later instantiations of federal policy. Can you talk a little bit about that idea, where it comes from, what the evidence for it is, and so on?
Right. It didn't just come to be. It was, in fact, designed. In fact, what realtors had done was create this whole racial system, a system in which even if somebody was offering you more money for a house, an owner wouldn't take an offer from an African-American buyer, a doctor or a lawyer. So to sell that, remember, realtors weren't all the brokers in the country, and an owner didn't have to use a broker at all. They had to create the whole idea of racial restriction was that one minority would ruin a neighborhood. But how could they, in effect, so they became the anti-policeman, the local real estate board, in charge of trying to prevent this. But what rationale could they use to convince everybody you shouldn't make more money by selling to minorities who had fewer choices and therefore often had to pay 20% more for housing as a result of this racial system? So the answer was they came up with, you know, an axiom, if you will. What they argued was a scientific and economic principle. The Portland Real Estate Board said this in 1920, that our members, not because we have any prejudice, for we have none, shall all refuse to sell to a minority in any Caucasian neighborhood because it will lower the property values in that area. And this, the real estate, National Association Real Estate Boards, the organization of the realtors, sponsored the textbooks and the appraisal manuals that were written throughout the country, all of which, and taught at 165 universities, all of which said this as a matter of pure economic science, that a minority moving area will reduce property values by 50% or 30%. And this then got included in the code of ethics of the realtors in 1924 for all local real estate boards, saying that no member can sell to somebody who will reduce the property values neighbor. And who were the experts on who would do such a thing? The local real estate board. They were the experts on real estate value. This same principle, this same idea, then got adopted when the realtors basically were the key lobbyists for and the designers of the Federal Housing Administration in the 1930s. So FHA required developers to have racial covenants, and it was the realtors who did the drafts of the early redlining maps so that homes couldn't be sold in mixed areas out of the theory that homes in such a mixed area, property values will go down. Well, it turned out that this entire property value argument, and the phrasing for it was, in the words of the key appraiser, leading appraiser in the country, was undesirable human elements depreciate property values. Those are undesirable human elements. People were undesirable because, for pure economic reasons, not because you were prejudiced against them. So it basically took prejudice and made it seem scientific. It turned out, starting in the late 1940s, when appraisers, some independent appraisers, started actually checking, this wasn't what happened. In fact, mostly 2/3 to 3/4 of the cases when minorities entered white neighborhoods, prices went up for a very obvious reason. Just like in any restricted market, like in black markets during, you know, a war, if people are limited in where they can live, they'll pay more. And typically, blacks in America paid 20 to 30% more for the same quality housing. So it's not surprising that, yes, if they moved into an area, maybe fewer whites wanted to live there because that became the whole marketing pitch of the realtors, but minorities wanted to live there. So it turned out this was bogus. It was a lie. Luigi Laurenti did a study from Berkeley, went back, and he interviewed all the authors of these textbooks for 30 years. They all said the same thing. And he said, can I see the studies that this was based on? You know, where was the data? It turned out there was never any data. It was made up. But mid-century America, FHA, the whole system of the development of American suburbs was built on this premise. But by the late 1940s, this had been discredited, and realtors now needed a new way of rationalizing why neighborhoods had to be segregated.
So at the beginning of our conversation, Gene, you pointed out that there are two main themes that run through the book. The first is what we've been talking about, sort of the interest group story in some way, although you don't quite frame it that way, of local real estate boards and the way in which they shape not only California policies about land use and housing, but then how those policies spread throughout the United States and found them their way folded into federal policies. But the other piece of this story is in some ways a story about American political thought, about conservative political thought. And at the core of that is an argument that you make that these real estate interests built an argument that the right to discriminate should be understood to be a core freedom, and that by the time we get into the late 20th century, that becomes adopted as a principle of the conservative movement. First of all, tell me if you think that's a fair characterization.
No, that's exactly
great.
What.
So tell us a little bit about that story, if you would.
Okay, so you have to picture how realtors saw the world, which is they had created, by the end of World War II, an entire racial system where African Americans were excluded from 98% of new homes and 95% of neighborhoods. A system reinforced by FHA, reinforced by racial covenants, reinforced by realtor boards themselves who would expel or suspend or freeze up the business any broker who dared sell to a minority. That's how you had such a system, an ever-tightening system. But World War II posed a challenge to them as opposed to diehard segregationists in the South, which is World War II was fought in the culture and the ideology and the statements of leaders of both parties as a war for freedom for all Americans, in which all races would join in. And so you had... So the argument for the real estate, the property values things have been discredited. So how did you now sell segregation when there were millions of returning GIs, minority GIs, who had bought homes and were excluded by racial covenants from living there? And the way they did that, a realtor later became their national president, Charles Shattuck in Los Angeles, spoke at a meeting of West Side homeowners in Los Angeles, saying why they had to keep out returning minority GIs, many of whom with medals and Purple Hearts. And he needed a patriotic argument, an argument in the context of World War II. So he argued that Americans, that the reason they had to keep out other races was because to defend American freedom. He said, in our Constitution, it wasn't actually there, there's freedom of association, your right to exclude other people and other races. And everybody has this right. Negroes have this, Chinese have this, Mexicans have this, whites have this. We all have this right, and it's your patriotic duty to uphold that freedom. And they used this argument, your right to exclude other races, that was adopted at the same time by Strom Thurmond and the Dixiecrats in the 1948 election. They used this during the 1950s, even after racial covenants were outlawed in 1948, to continue and intensify segregation. Fair housing advocates, civil rights groups, started pushing fair housing laws to then end this monopoly. This racial monopoly, which is really how this system worked, starting in the late 50s and 60s, using the argument, in effect, of shared freedom that Martin Luther King, that was at the heart of the civil rights movement, that your freedom depends on everyone's freedom, that freedom belongs to the country as a whole. And they started getting city and state after state in the country to pass fair housing laws in a few places, in Massachusetts and Colorado. Local realtors decided they would go along with it. But in many places, California being the most noteworthy, realtors decided when fair housing laws were passed that they would try and outlaw them by going to voters. And so in 1964, on the ballot in California, they placed a state constitutional amendment that would forever prohibit fair housing. It would authorize discrimination and say you could never limit residential discrimination. This is the same time the Civil Rights Act is being passed in Congress, and most Californians are in favor. But realtors, here was an amendment that had never been in any state constitution. No state constitution, even in the Deep South, authorized discrimination. So how did you fight publicly with voters for why discrimination should continue? This is at the height of the Civil Rights Movement, the height of American liberalism, as Lyndon Johnson was going to defeat Barry Goldwater by the largest margin in history. The realtors were politically isolated. No prominent politician, not Barry Goldwater, not Ronald Reagan, would support them for fear of seeming racist. So they decided that the answer, the approach, was to redefine American freedom and to say that freedom means the freedom to discriminate. They would, in effect, challenge the idea of shared freedom from Martin Luther King to Marshall and Washington with a very different idea of freedom. Freedom as your personal private property, your right to control who you sold to and therefore who your neighbors could be. And they made this seem, they invented what became colorblind freedom, saying, well, we're in favor of the same rights for blacks and for whites, which was namely the right of all owners to discriminate. They never mentioned the right of people to buy a house in the first place or of tenants. So they took a technique, which has then been used by conservatives on issue after issue, from guns to abortion, everything else, which is to take a single narrow right, one that had never been talked about in this case before, an owner's right to say, I have a right, a freedom to take somebody, to not choose somebody who's willing to pay me more for my house on racial grounds. They took this right, they elevated this narrow right as being, they defined it as sort of a litmus test of American freedom itself. This is what freedom means. And they argued, saying, we're in favor of equal rights for all. We're in favor of this freedom. So what does freedom really mean? They said freedom means freedom of choice. And they said, what is discrimination? Discrimination is just means to choose. So on billboards around on freeways in Los Angeles, the headline or the banner read, freedom of choice. Vote for Proposition 14. That was the name of the proposition. So in effect, their argument said to millions of Californians, a relatively liberal, moderate state, said, look, to be for Proposition 14, to permanently authorize discrimination, doesn't mean you personally are prejudiced. It means you believe in American freedom and that you're willing to defend American freedom against liberal government who is trying to take it away from you. It's not minorities who are the enemy. It's liberal government. You're the underdog. You're the individual homeowner. So they created this notion of the ordinary American being penalized by liberal government, sort of make a transcendent issue. The result was, and it stunned politicians of both parties, that 65% of the voters supported Proposition 14, 75% of white voters, 80% of white union voters, who normally been part of the Democratic Party. On the same ballot where Lyndon Johnson defeated Goldwater by almost 60 to 40. So here was a message. Here was a way of thinking about freedom that was then adopted by Ronald Reagan 2 years later when he was running for governor, after Proposition 14 was ruled unconstitutional. He adopted this idea of individual freedom. He said, if a man wants to discriminate against a Negro or others in selling or renting his house, it is his right to do so. This is American freedom. This idea of freedom, freedom as your own personal property, as an absolute right that can't be limited like freedom of speech or freedom of the press, but is like freedom of religion. In fact, they linked it to freedom of religion. They said, this is a matter of the dictates of conscience. If, just like you can't restrict religion, you can't restrict discrimination. So they made this the centerpiece. Eventually, fair housing got passed federally in the days after Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968. But it was so weakened by congressional fears of the voter rebellion of Proposition 14, it's remained relatively weak ever since. But even more important, this idea of freedom became the centerpiece of the conservative movement. And it became the centerpiece because it solved three structural problems that were necessary for conservatives to become powerful in this country from being a very small minority in the 1960s. One was conservatives were split between social conservatives, traditionalists, favor of school prayer in the schools and religion, and libertarians, who were sort of an exactly opposite view. So this used the language of libertarianism, of absolute individual rights, your right to do anything you wanted, to enforce social conformity, to enforce community traditions. This use, libertarian language, to, in effect, reclaim a past tradition of community, of how things should be, that's the way conservatives have used freedom ever since. The second thing that this approach did was it created a transcendent image of our politics, that politics weren't about issues about balancing this right against that right, but they were about American freedom itself. A transcendent image let people see themselves as engaged in a sacred fight over all these issues. And the same technique of elevating a narrow absolute right as American freedom itself could then be used on abortion, the rights of the fetus, over writing, as we see in Texas today, on guns, that guns didn't mean things you could regulate, it was an absolute right, on campaign finance restrictions, on regulating business, whatever campaign finance
restrictions. Vaccine mandates? Same idea.
What? Yeah, mass
vaccine mandates.
Exactly. This same idea permeates the country. And the third problem it solved was the problem of the creation of what would become a new kind of Republican Party, for the first time in modern America, a national conservative political party. Back in the 1950s, Democrats and Republicans had wide ranges of, groups on the right and left. But in 1948, Charles Wallace Collins, a Southern lawyer, argued that in order to ultimately defend Jim Crow, the only way to do so was if Southern Democrats left the Democratic Party and joined with Northern Republicans, pro-business Republicans, in a common party, as long as those Republicans would pledge to leave Jim Crow alone, to not impose civil rights. So here was the idea of a national political party united by limiting the federal government's right to control, race, to protect minorities, and protecting business against regulation. Here was the idea. By 1964, when Strom Thurmond joined the Republican Party after Goldwater, this became politically possible. But it needed an ideology that could work both North and South. That ideology of colorblind freedom that the realtors had had to create in California, if it could work in California, it could work anywhere. So it solved that problem. So you created, in effect, a national party organized around this idea of freedom. And the dynamics of such a party naturally, when that's the key central idea, naturally lead it toward leaders who more and more will embrace that as the only meaning of American freedom. And so therefore you see, and the results during COVID are incredibly striking of this. You have Donald Trump, as in Michael Wolff's new book, told by his advisors, he really should be in favor of mask mandates. This would help. It would help win re-election. He said, I can't do that. It's off brand. Because it's outside the domain of the Republican Party. You see DeSantis having use this argument of freedom, he now therefore has to violate most basic conservative principles of local schools deciding what happens in the schools and of businesses being able to, decide what customers they serve and how they deal with employees. And you see Abbott in Texas, who is facing a challenge from the right because of his own mask mandates this year, has to be against mask mandates. So it isn't like to aspire to leadership in this Republican Party doesn't mean you have a choice on vaccine and mask mandates, because this is, to do so would be to be off brand against the central idea that has united the conservative movement. Because, and here's the key thing, this same argument, you think of the conservative movement as all these separate causes, but what they've had in common is this same technique of using American freedom, this idea of absolute individual freedom on issue after issue. So the more, so that unites, it's not an advantageous alliance of different interest groups, but every time that issue is raised, that argument is raised, it reinforces the same message. So that becomes the dominant message that shifted the country to the right for all these years. And it was a message that was designed to perpetuate segregation in the first place, to keep, because absolute freedom for some always means government can't protect the rights of others. That's what absolute freedom means. And that's its central idea.
You're listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking with Gene Slater about his new book, Free to Discriminate, How the Nation's Realtors Created Housing Segregation and the Conservative Vision of American Freedom, new out from Heyday Books. Gene, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.